Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Centre. I'm Bishnu Shom on the programme tonight. The latest on an ongoing encounter in Anantnag in Kashmir, in which three officers, an army colonel, a major and a police DSP have been killed in action. The mortal remains of two of the three have been recovered. What we will be doing on this discussion is look at the evolving nature of the threat in Kashmir and ambushes by an increasingly vicious enemy. Next on the programme, India's big aviation growth boom. A truly remarkable story. I'll be joined by the Civil Aviation Minister, Jyotiraditya Sindhya, on how India could be a global hub like Singapore or Dubai or Doha within just the next 5 years, and how Delhi Airport is set to become the world's second largest in months. But first, let me go straight across to NDTV's Nazir Masoodi, who joins us for the latest on the encounter in Anantnag. Nazir, what are you hearing?
Well, Vishnu, this operation is underway, and the special forces have also been rushed there because it is unclear whether the bodies of Colonel Manpreet and the Major Ashish have been recovered. The body of DSP Himayu Muzammil Bhatt was retrieved, and it was taken to
Srinagar. What I have been told in just the last little while is that two of the three bodies have been recovered.
There's some situation for whole day. The security force were actually working very hard to retrieve the body. First, the effort was to evacuate the injured because all the three were first injured. Now, the body of DSP Himayu Muzammil Bhatt, and he was recovered, and there was a wreath-laying ceremony that was attended by J&K's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha, DGP, and other top officials of the administration. But this operation is going on, which was started late last night after army and police received specific information about presence of militants in the place called Gadol. Gadol Forest in Kukernag in Anantnag district. They launched the joint operation, but they came under heavy firing in the morning. Our sources tell us, DSP, Himayu Muzammil called his senior officer that he's injured. He has received multiple bullets in his one spinal cord. And then, there was an effort, huge effort through the day to, evacuate the injured. But because of the heavy firing from the militant side, it was not possible. And for whole day, that was the effort. This clearly shows that the militants were well entrenched, and it appears to be a plan, ambush. And it's not the first time in the same area last month, Kulgam district when three soldiers were killed in a similar ambush in that area. Remember, this year it appears that there's change in the complexion of militancy in Jammu and Kashmir, be it Rajouri, Poonch, which were free from militancy for more near two decades. Now there's a resurgence of militancy in that area, and in May, 10 soldiers were killed, including five special force officials. Those were two major ambushes on the army. Even yesterday, there was an encounter in the Rajouri in which one army soldier was killed. Two militants were also killed, and four army security force personnel were injured, and army even lost one of its assault dogs in that encounter. So clearly, when we see militancy, that is the last leg, but we see such major, attack and the major, encounters in the army has suffered huge, huge casualties. This is, after a long time, senior army officer, the colonel rank officer, who is the commander of the 19 Rashtra Rifles, his major, and a deputy superintendent of Jammu and Kashmir, they have been killed in the line of their line of duty. So this operation is alive. Senior army officers, including the GOC of 15 Corps, DGP Jammu and Kashmir Dilbagh Singh, ADGP Vijay Kumar, and other senior officers rushed to the encounter site. For whole day, they were supervising the trying evacuation and also the how to track down the militants. But it appears to be a very, very tough operation given
and
the terrain.
The wreath has been laid on the DSP, right? The images that we actually see on our screen right now is of the DSP's mortal remains. After having been brought, he's the officer being honored presently on our screens, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Himayu, Muzammil Bhatt is a young, Jammu and Kashmir Police Services officer. His father was also a police officer, now a retired, J&K police officer, a very decorated officer. So the son of that officer who was actually serving in Jammu and Kashmir Police in this area, he was part of this operation along with and actually leading from the front, along with Colonel Manpreet and Major Ashish. When they came under this heavy firing, his mortal remains were brought to Srinagar. At Srinagar's District Police Lines, the wreath-laying ceremony is being held. Jammu and Kashmir's Lieutenant Governor laid the wreath. So did other senior officers, including the DGP, Jammu and Kashmir Chief Secretary, and the officials, as you can see, individuals. So clearly a huge loss, and the family, this officer, a fallen officer, belongs to the Tral area of Pulwama district. So after that, this body would be taken there for the last rites. Yeah. It's a huge, huge loss for the army and the police, even as this encounter and the operation is still underway to track down the heavily armed militants in this particular area.
Well, joining us now, Lieutenant General Syed Atta Hasnain. He's a former general officer commanding a 15 Corps, knows this area inside out. General, firstly, your thoughts. You know, the loss of three men over here, it is absolutely tragic. Just your thoughts on the loss of these two army officers and one police officer.
Vishnu, very, very deep regrets. Very deep regrets. I can always feel for this because one has gone through this so many times. The last time we lost a commanding officer, I think, was in 2020 when CO-21 RR met his end at he died of his wounds in the Handwara area. This area where this operation has happened at Kokarnag is the same area where Burhan Wani was also neutralized, if you remember. 19 RR, the CO who has unfortunately, Kalmanpreet, who's unfortunately no more, was the CO of 19 RR. And this is the unit which was responsible for the neutralization of Burhan Wani in 2016. It's a Sikh Ally unit. It's not often that you find that a commanding officer, a company commander, and a local police officer, who's the DYSP there, all three get neutralized. Of course, the first thought is that the Indian Armed Forces, the Indian Army, the police, Jammu and Kashmir police, always lead from the front. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, one tends to regret a thing like this happening. It happens very often to my mind because there is a rush for results.
Yes.
And our officers are there right in front. And these encounters these days are infrequent. And sometimes there may be a slight hurry to conduct the operations. Not that you can blame anyone here, because these situations are best known to the people who are on the ground. And what happens, any mistake which has been made, etc., you cannot sort of go into the critical aspects of it, because only the man on the ground can actually tell you what has finally happened. So very unfortunate that we have had these losses after fairly long, but it just shows that the path to normalcy in Jammu and Kashmir is still strewn with lots of these military operations which will have to be conducted from time to time,
yep,
although very infrequent at the moment.
But General, let me ask you this. Just in the last couple of months, there's the name of another Pakistani terrorist group which seems to be involved in a lot of these attacks. There was that horrific attack on a truck in the Jammu region, or the greater Jammu region, which took place a few months back. And, you know, ambushes are the technique which are used. Is this something new that we are seeing?
Vishnu, I think these are two separate things.
Okay.
What has happened in Rajouri was a chance encounter, an ambush on a single vehicle, which unfortunately was running against the rules at that particular time. Thereafter, there was a second encounter in which we lost five very brave paracommandos also, if you remember, in a search operation. So this was all south of the Pir Panjal. North of the Pir Panjal, in this area, this does not seem to be an ambush kind of an operation. This seems to be an intelligence-based operation, on which search was being carried out by initially by the company commander's party. And thereafter, as per routine always, it is the CO's party which moves on to build up on the company commander's party. So this was probably the CO's QRT as such, which has built up on the company commander's party. The DYSP probably accompanied him alongside, because all operations in the Jammu and Kashmir Valley are conducted jointly by the police, CRPF and the army together. And that's how it happened. I don't think there has been any case of an ambush or anything of that kind. It's a plain encounter. It's an encounter which has taken place in a search operation. Now, in search operations, you have to remember, the initiative is with the terrorist. He is hiding, he's undercover, and he can take you on because he can see you. So the first burst, normally, it is the terrorist who has the advantage. Thereafter, the army, of course, carries out a cordon. The forces carry out a cordon and neutralize the terrorists. So this seems to have what has happened in this particular case.
General, RR, for the benefit of our viewers, Rashtriya Rifles, this is a dedicated anti-terror force, right? And, you know, they have a reputation of great ferocity. They've handled terrorists in Kashmir for decades now, right?
See, Vishnu, the Rush Rifles was raised in 1991, initially actually for Punjab. But then when the problem started off in 89, 1991 in Jammu and Kashmir, things started going out of hand. The Rush Rifles focus shifted completely to Jammu and Kashmir. There are total 63 battalions. Initially, there were 36 battalions which were raised. These are 63 battalions today. Now, one of the things which one must know is each of these battalions is affiliated to a infantry regiment of the Indian Army. For example, this particular unit, 19RR, is affiliated to the Sikh Light Infantry. So they will have Sikh troops with them. Alongside, I'm not certain, but I think this has also got an artillery element with it. Most RR units, almost all RR units will have a 30% element which will be from another arm, like armored corps, artillery, air defense, or engineers. This add on to the infantry strength, and then you have your own logistics. So it's 1100 strong. It's a 6-company unit, and it is an amazing thing, the kind of, because it remains permanently. Now, this particular unit, as far as I can recall, since 2008, it has been at this location in Kokarnag. So you can imagine people have come, people have gone, but the intelligence remains intact institutionally with the unit.
Yeah.
They know this area backwards. They would know every single source, every single bad element, everyone that would be known to them. That's what I said. This kind of an encounter is a chance happening. And you cannot blame anyone for it ever.
General, I'm just trying to understand, is it your belief that this was a Pakistani group which was involved? The terrorists fighting are Pakistani.
Vishnu, my understanding is that in the current circumstances, the Pakistanis are restricted primarily to North Kashmir. South Kashmir, for the last couple of years, has had more local content. I'm not sure about it. I don't have authentic information. But to my mind, this should be a local group, most likely. If it is a Pakistani group, then there are two contingencies by which it could have reached here. One is that it has come from Jammu over the Pir Panjal and has entered into this area and probably was a new group. That seems to be a very remote chance. The other is that it has gravitated from the north. It has come through the Shamshabari, one of the areas of the routes on the Shamshabari, gravitated into North Kashmir, and then via the Thral route, via Thral and areas around Bijbihara and Anantnag, it has finally infiltrated up till here. That also seems to be a very remote chance, because it's not very easy to get past the dragonet of the security forces. So to my mind, it seems to be a local group, probably homegrown right there itself in the area of South Kashmir.
You know, just about a year and a half or 2 years back, we were looking at a complete reduction in terrorist violence in Jammu and Kashmir. It seems to be on the upswing once again. There is no group which operates independent of Pakistani support. And yet the LOC is entirely peaceful. So it's a bit of a duality now, isn't it? A peaceful LOC and yet these groups, even if they are Indian indigenous groups, getting some sort of help from Pakistan. How is it happening?
Well, there are, you see, Vishnu, there is a element of porosity which is there in the line of control. One can never claim that we have got zero infiltration. There will be some element which has probably penetrated through, because as I always tell my audiences everywhere, you put your hand out, stretch your hand in the night, and you will not be able to probably see the tip of your hand itself. It's so dark in these areas. And so you can't have a man at every meter. So there will be infiltration, and through those infiltrating elements and odd elements will come in. Also, you are finding a lot of drone activity taking place in the Jammu region, in the Punjab region, and somehow or the other, odd weapons, smaller weapons, etc., some ID materials sometimes, and of course, fake currency and drugs manage to reach Kashmir through these various routes. Now, having said that, you see that we have to understand that when you have a strength of 60 to 100 terrorists left in the valley, incidents will be very few. And the efforts by the army and the rest of the security forces will be intense to try and wipe them out. I always call it the last mile effect. Mm-hmm. In the last mile effect, you will invariably suffer some casualties. You see, otherwise, normally it happens, you lose one soldier and kill 5-6 terrorists. Now, in the current cases, you will find you lose 2 soldiers and kill 2 terrorists or 3 terrorists. That's about all. So this is an inevitable thing which happens when there's a drawdown and terrorism is coming to an end in a particular area. I again wish to confirm to you, normalcy, when we say normalcy, the absence of violence is not normalcy. Normalcy has many other parameters.
Sure.
But within normalcy, there will be some elements of this kind of violence which will continue to take place.
I'd like to thank you, General, as usual, for, you know, speaking to us, you know, sharing your knowledge of the area and a situation like this. It's just so unfortunate when you see, you know, any soldier being killed, but a commanding officer, you know, of a unit is, you know, it's different. One has to think about the men in that formation as well. You know, there is an issue of morale in any force, certainly in the Indian Army, a major loss as well. And certainly that very brave police officer, the son of a police officer who was killed in action today. Thanks, General, very much for being with us. My very deep regrets too,
Vishnu.
No, absolutely, absolutely. It's horrific, absolutely. Thank you, sir, very much for being with us. Well, we're going to move on now to something completely different. Earlier in the day, I spoke to the Civil Aviation Minister, Jyotiraditya Scindia, and we ended up talking about so much. We spoke about the boom in the Indian aviation sector, how within a period of 5 years, he felt that India could have at least one hub along the lines of, say, what Dubai is as an aviation hub, or Singapore, or Doha in Qatar for that matter. And the growth of Delhi Airport, which is said to be, by footfall, passengers among the largest, in fact, the second largest in the world. There are challenges as well. How does he intend to address them? Listen in. Well, one of the sectors in the Indian economy which has shown remarkable growth over the last several years and is really closely aligned, some would suggest, with India's economic progress going forward is the aviation sector. Now, there are plenty of challenges there, but there is plenty of hope and plenty of promise. We've got the Civil Aviation Minister with us, Jyotiraditya Scindia. We are both extremely passionate about aviation. Great to have you. Let me ask you a direct question and ask you for some years or dates in mind. We want India to become an international aviation hub like Singapore, like Dubai, like Doha. Given the pace and the growth, how many more years would that likely take in your estimate?
So first of all, Vishnu, thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on the show with you. aviation has really started on its growth curve now in India. I think a market that was very saturated on the domestic front, the growth of both, on the one hand, airports, from 74 airports in 2014 to 149. I just inaugurated a new airport 3 days ago in Utkela in Orissa. So we are at 149 airports now, not 148. In terms of fleet size, from 400 to 700. And in terms of the number of travelers, from 6 crores to almost 14.5 crores. What are the projections going forward? The projections going forward are, as far as airports are concerned, touching 200 to 220 by 2030. As far as planes are concerned, going from our current fleet size of 700 to almost about 1,500 by 2030. And similarly, as far as passengers are concerned, going from current 14.5 crores to, some studies have projected, almost 42.5 crores by 2030. Now, that's the phenomenal growth that you see. When that happens, and specifically that must happen on the international side. Because until now, our carriers have been very concentrated on growing capacity on the domestic side. And therefore narrow-bodied aircraft. You've now seen carriers like Air India, IndiGo, place orders for 470 aircraft on one hand and 500 aircraft on the other. Both orders comprising of a decent amount of, on the one hand, large body with Boeing and Airbus with Air India. And as far as IndiGo is concerned, with A321 XLRs, which can do a distance of almost 6-7 hours. Now, once that happens, then the concept of an international hub also becomes I wouldn't want to say a low-hanging fruit, but an opportunity for India. India for too long has had its hub either on its eastern border or western border. We're currently working with DIAL to look at setting up a hub in Delhi to start with. But what I feel is in the next decade or so, the capability of India to have not necessarily only a single hub, but multiple hubs.
Yes.
One in Delhi, one in South India, one on the western side. That capability certainly is there. But I think we need to start with one, engage and make sure that the proof of concept takes off. And once that does happen, then replicate that going forward. Too many of our travelers today go via a third country.
It's a one-stop.
And I think it's important to, instead of Sixth Freedom, really looking at direct flights and therefore creating that hub structure within India.
So to answer my question, 5 years before we get at least one truly global hub, given the pace of expansion, or 10 years?
Well, I think you could look at a roadmap of 5 years. I would want it to be sooner, but I'm not going to divulge a date closer than 5 years. I believe that I think it's important to undercommit and overdeliver, as opposed to overcommitting and underdelivering.
All right. So 5 years, that's an interesting statistic nonetheless. At one level, there is pressure, and I use that word loosely, on you, because we've got the companies coming up with massive orders. They're banking on the Indian economy. They're banking on your ministry. Can your ministry match the infrastructure requirements required for 1,000-plus aircraft within, let's say, the next decade easily? And by that, it's parking bays. It's space for engineering, ground support, physical space in airports. What are you doing to match the demand which exists?
So I think that's it's a very important question. And I think always the toss-up is, do you put the cart before the horse or the horse before the cart? And I think it's important to create capacity. And which is why you've seen the scorching pace at which Prime Minister's government in the last 9 years has gone from 74 airports to 149 airports, water drones and heliports.
Yeah.
And when I give you a target of 200, 220 plus by 2030, mm-hmm. you're looking at a capacity addition of almost 50% more from the current level, right? So that's the kind of pace that we're looking at. Now, when you talk about throughput capability, and I think there your question is centered really on the metros.
Yes.
If you look at Delhi Airport today, we have a throughput capability of 70 million.
Yes.
That capability is going to go to 109 million come this December. What does that mean? That means that Delhi is going to become one of the largest airports in the world. Not in the subcontinent, not in Asia, but in the world. We're going to be, if at all, second only to in Atlanta.
Right.
Right? So that's the kind of scale you're looking at. In the next 12 months, you will have the inauguration of Jewar Airport.
Yes.
At almost 12 million, which will grow in its capacity by 2030 to almost 60 million
right.
there. So between these two airports, you're going to have close to about 160 million throughput capability. Bombay is capped out already at about 50, 60 million. Navi Mumbai is coming up, which will grow to another 50, 60 million. Chennai, we are growing capacity from 25 million to almost about 45 million. Similar is the case in Hyderabad. Calcutta at 35 million going to 55 million.
Right.
So therefore, current six metro capacity in India, which is in the range of about 220 million throughput capability, is going to go to almost 430 million in the next 4 to 5 years. So in terms of being able to cater to growing passengers, I think that's something that we have already planned for. Having said that, the private sector and the public sector has a very aggressive infrastructure capex plan in place, close to about 98,000 crores
yes.
over the next 3 to 5 years, of which Airports Authority of India has a capex plan of roughly 25,000 crores, and the balance 63,000 crores is the private sector. AI is going to look at expansion of almost 42 brownfield airports and 3 greenfield airports, out of which one has already been built up in terms of Holongi. Similarly, the private sector in their 63,000 crore capex is looking at 7 brownfield airports and 2 greenfield airports, out of which Mopagua, 3 greenfield airports, out of which Mopagua has already been built
yes.
out, and Jewar and Navi Mumbai is being built out. So there's a huge thrust in civil aviation. And I believe, and I'm putting my neck out there on the line, but I believe in the next decade or so, civil aviation is going to become the bulwark of transportation in India for a large number of people, even larger than just the first AC and second AC of railways, because our competition is an AC product by the very nature of the fact that an aircraft is air-conditioned.
Delhi Airport, you said, will become the second largest in the world in a finite period of
time. If not the largest.
By when?
By this December.
By this December.
109 million.
You will be the second largest airport.
Correct.
In the world. And correct. You are set to exceed Atlanta in a period going forward.
Sure. But I'm just saying you'll be at 109 million capacity by December, Jan.
We'll talk about airfares in just a bit, because that's an important point that you raised. But there are smaller airlines in India which are struggling to survive. There's a legal battle SpiceJet is going through. GoFirst is, in financial distress, barely exists right now, technically exists. Is this shake-up in the industry, which a lot of people said would likely take place, isn't that a bad thing for the customer? Because if you have a duopoly-type situation, two very large airlines, then fares would likely go up.
Well, if you look at the economic basis of your statement, it's unfounded. By its very nature, the aviation business is a very inelastic business in terms of pricing. The minute you start raising prices, your demand drops off a cliff. So it's not an elastic market.
Right.
That being said, as civil aviation minister, I would like to have a minimum of four to five players in the space.
Akasa is a strong third, in fact, so I should...
I was just going to come to that. So while we do talk about the airlines which are undergoing some issues at this point of time, and that is pertaining to their way of doing business and not the industry in itself, so there's very little that one can do to intervene, whether they are contractual issues or whether they're the legal issues. For the first time in over two decades, you've seen a new airline being born in India in the form of Akasa. And you've seen that fledgling, nestling airline go from two aircraft to 20 aircraft in a period of 12 months.
Yeah.
Now, that's a record,
right?
Across the world, that's a record. So my hat's off to them in terms of how they've grown their capacity. They also have a very ambitious target of going to almost 70 airplanes in the next 3 to 4 years. Having said that, Vishnu, also I think it's important for you to concentrate on the smaller aircraft, the regional airlines. Udaan, the Ude Desh Ka Aam Nagri scheme, has not only connected people, has not only connected cities, but it has, in its wake, given birth to 3 to 4 new airlines in this country. Fly 91 was born because of Udaan. Fly Big has been born because of Udaan. India One Air has been born because of Udaan. Star Air has been born because of Udaan. And so therefore you're seeing a huge spurt in regional connectivity to not tier 1 to tier 2, but really tier 2 to tier 3 and tier 3 to even tier 4 cities with 9-seater aircraft and 3-seater aircraft. And that's the revolution that is going to be unfolding itself in India over the next couple of years as well.
But let me ask you, there's a CAG report that has come out.
So there will be a hub and spoke arrangement where a lot of these smaller regional airlines and smaller aircraft will feed onto the tier 2 cities, which will then be taken on by the narrow-bodied aircraft to tier 1 and other cities.
And so that's the chain. But, you know, be direct, as you always are with us. Are you somewhat disappointed at the pace at which Udaan has developed as a scheme? Because if you look at the CAG report, 52% of awarded regional routes could not commence operations. Only 30% of regional routes which commenced ops have completed 3 years during the initial period.
So
we wanted
I think, Vishnu, in life, you can always say a glass is half full or a glass is half empty, right? The fact that the scheme was born in 2016, it's only been 7 years. And the fact that you have 495 routes that have connected people that were never ever connected by civil aviation in this country ever before. the fact that cities that were on the civil aviation map in World War II and were obliterated from that map soon after World War II are now being reconnected by civil aviation. Case in point for you is a city on the western coast on the eastern coast of Orissa, Jharsuguda, Rup Sin, Assam, Kishangarh in Rajasthan, Darbhanga in Bihar, all completely unconnected. Third point, the fact that four regional airlines have been born because of Udaan. There was no way they would have even come into existence if Udaan had not been in place, if a viability gap funding principle had not been in place. Fourth point, the fact that through Udaan you have built out 74 airports. 74 airports in this country on a regional basis have been built out because of the funding from Udaan, 4,500 crores. Utkela was the last one, which I inaugurated, right?
But why? So,
when you roll out a scheme, the scheme has to have, people like yourselves have always argued that there must be a sunset clause.
Yes.
So every scheme has to have a sunset clause, sure, right? And so Udaan has a sunset clause of 3 years.
Yes.
That I will give you this viability gap funding for 3 years. So you will be able to fly that route based on my VGF for 3 years.
Yeah.
Post that, either it becomes viable and carries on, or if it doesn't, then we've got to look at other routes.
Right.
Right? And the fact that you've got at least close to about 25 to 30% of those routes today becoming sustainable in terms of eventual routes, right? That itself is a huge feather in the cap for civil aviation. And all the 4 points that I mentioned to you, which would have never happened, the very fact today that through Udaan, you have carried 1 crore 31 lakh passengers in this country in the last 7 years who would have never flown in an aircraft.
No, I agree. I agree. And these numbers...
And you've had 234,000, 2,34,000 flights through Udaan, which would have never happened.
No, but I understand this. And these numbers are absolutely correct. I'm just trying to understand why have many of those routes not...
There have been many reasons.
Is it the airlines?
So there have been many reasons. Many times the airline has bid and then has decided not to ply that route.
Yes.
Many times the airline has started a route and then it's had some... Because it had only one aircraft and the aircraft had an engineering problem and it got grounded. And therefore, it's not been able to finish that route. So what we've done this time around, the two changes that I've brought about in Udaan. Number one, I have moved from ATR aircraft, which was the smallest aircraft at that point of time, 72-seater, to small aircraft and helicopters. So
yes.
I've created specific Udaan routes, Udaan rounds, 5.1 and 5.2. And before that, I think it was 4.1 for helicopters and small planes. To connect your 9-seaters, your helicopters. We've got almost about 25 routes in Uttarakhand that are operational today on helicopters, about 9 routes in Himachal, about close to 16 to 18 routes in the northeast on helicopter. Small aircraft, we've got the round going on as we speak, which is 5.2. That's the one tweak that we've done. The second tweak that we are contemplating and thinking of doing is we're going to put in place a structure such that if you come in and bid for a route and then you do not ply that route, maybe in 2 months or 3 months, there is some kind of a penalty on you as well, right? And that will wean out the not-so-serious players and make sure only the serious players actually come in and bid for those routes. So we are doing that as we go along as well.
There was criticism, and I think a part of it was somewhat unfounded, on airfares going up massively.
The other thing that we are also thinking of doing is, right now, Udaan is limited to 500 kilometers or 600 kilometers in terms of distance. So, therefore, what you do by doing that is you actually limit your radial, limit your radius.
So, you've increased that.
So what we are thinking of doing is saying you can fly as far as you want. And this is still on the drawing board. But the VGF, the viability gap funding, will only be for that 500 off, let's say, for example, a 1,000-kilometer route. Only the 500.
So you're tweaking Mission Udaan.
So we're trying to tweak it to make it...
More attractive.
Not to make it more attractive, to give variability, to make it more viable and to draw in more players.
Okay. You know, there was this period a couple of months back where last-minute fares went up massively in only a handful of sectors. And the argument which was raised was that, look, you know, these prices are huge. But they did settle within days, in fact, almost in all cases.
So
to what extent does the government need to be involved in regulating fares, or
first,
should it?
So first of all, civil aviation is a deregulated sector. So the government cannot regulate a deregulated sector. Having said that, what happened in June was, a spike or an anomaly. Two things coincided at the same time.
Go first was one, right?
No. The first is that the civil aviation sector is a cyclical sector within a year. So you have high season and low season. So, and therefore you have high prices and low prices. From Dasera, which is October until Jan, is high season, where you have a lot of people traveling. Demand goes up, prices go up. And this is an international phenomena. Thanksgiving, New Year's, Christmas, all of that internationally. Then you have low season from Feb till about April, May. Then the summer holidays come. And so you have high season again until monsoon. And then from July till September again is low season. So it's a cyclical in terms of prices and demand, one affecting the other. Now what happened is you normally have this cycle. But in between of a high season, you also had an airline with almost 30 aircraft being grounded.
Right.
So capacity got sucked out of the system.
Sure.
So A, you had high demand.
Yeah.
And then you had almost close to a 5 to 7% drawdown on capacity.
Sure.
So you had a double whammy
happen
at the same time.
Right.
And therefore, you had certain cities which were primarily connected by by Go.
With Srinagar, for example.
Leh, is huge. Srinagar, Pune, Ahmedabad, Goa, which had an abnormal rise in fares. And so we had a meeting on the 5th of June, and I called in the airlines, and I said that this is not tenable, and this is not right. And we had a very free and frank discussion, and soon after that we actually saw, and I started monitoring the prices on a daily basis, and you saw the normalization of fares happen.
All right, one final question, heliports. Helicopter aviation in this country is still fledgling. You've spoken briefly about that. What more do you think needs to be done to encourage helicopter aviation in India?
So what we've done is we've taken a number of steps. So first of all, I brought about a new helicopter policy where I dismantled a lot of the regulatory conditions, making it easier for people to fly helicopters in terms of permissions, and we put up a heli portal for permissions, direct permissions. We circulated a Heli Disha booklet to all 600 collectors across the country to make them understand the parameters that a helipad must have, what are the radial distances from obstructions that should be in place. And along with that, we started bringing out this new Udaan round just for helicopters. And we've actually seen a proliferation of that happen. I firmly believe that now as people are getting used to, and we also have a VGF system. So therefore earlier you had helicopter travel available to you, but it was away from your budget and my budget. Now with this VGF, you actually brought the prices down to almost 3,500 or 4,000 rupees for a particular sector. Badrinath, Kedarnath and so on and so forth, or the Northeast, for example. And therefore now people are availing of these facilities. And I think there will be a growth in both helicopter fleet as well as flying in the days to come, as soon as this Udaan round is.
I didn't ask you about flight safety. I know it's a huge, huge issue for you, perhaps top of your mind. You know, there is this issue of boorish passengers, and it's not unique to India. It happens all over the world. That said, you know, we have to set a very firm signal. Do you believe that the system in putting people on a no-fly list is strong enough? Are you constantly revising that? What have been some of your conversations with airlines in this regard?
So as far as unruly passengers are concerned, that's a wild card, if you will,
if I may
use that term. Because no one knows how you or I are going to behave when we board a flight. But having said that, I think it's important to, as you said, to set examples and to set precedents. And we have been extremely strong on coming down on any unruly passenger on any of our airlines, whether it is through following the legal process, whether it is putting that person on a no-fly list for an extended period of time, and so on and so forth. Whatever processes we have at our command, we use those completely to make sure that when you fly, you're not only responsible for yourself, you're responsible for everyone else on that flight. And then you need to board that plane with that sense of responsibility.
Sure. Wonderful speaking to you, Minister. Jyotiraditya Sindhya telling us a lot about the future of this particular sector. It is tremendous. There are no two ways about it. It's really a question of when India becomes even larger than we are in terms of becoming a truly global hub. But the potential is incredible. The demand is also incredible. There's so much to discuss in this.